Hello again, everybody. Great to have you along as we welcome you to yet another edition of Leadership America, creating champions of change through a culture of civility. And oh my, don't we need that in this country right now. My name is Scott Murray.
And I'm Angel Carlton, and I'm coming to you live from Taos, New Mexico. So I'm going a little casual today, Scott. We're on our way back, taking the scenic route back to Dallas from Denver. So I'm in this beautiful surrounding.
Anything you want to share about the cap and where that came from?
Oh, well, it's really early here.
All right, we understand.
Ball cap day.
Well, we're delighted to have you on board. Thanks, Angel. And our special guest, I know we're really excited about. He's a, you hate to show favorites, but he's one of my favorite of all time when it comes to professional football players. I remember when he was at Syracuse University and, of course, was the number two draft pick of the Dallas Cowboys right after the overall number one pick in the NFL draft back in 1989, the very year that Jerry Jones bought the Cowboys. And Troy Aikman out of UCLA was the number one pick, had been here a couple of weeks or a couple of months prior in the UCLA-Arkansas Cotton Bowl game. And now 3-4 months later, the Cowboys had a new owner, and he was the number one pick overall. And who was number two overall? Darryl Johnston, the Moose, out of Syracuse University, 39th pick overall in the draft. So pretty good stuff. And he came down here, All-American, up in New York State, but now is in the great state of Texas. So you remember those days, I'm sure?
Oh, yes, I do. Yep. Season tickets. And it was a very, very exciting time to be a Cowboys fan.
Well, 1-15, as you probably well remember, that first year with Jimmy Johnson as the new head coach, was destined for the Hall of Fame, was supposed to have been inducted this year, this summer, but now, of course, going to have to wait till next year because of the pandemic. But bottom line is that it was really something special to see all these guys come together after that 1-15 year. And within 3 years, it was 92, 93, and 95. The Cowboys become the first team to win 3 Super Bowls in 4 years. And Darryl has 3 of those Super Bowl rings. So with that said and done, we simply say, welcome, my friend. How you doing, number 48?
Yeah, I'm good. Good to be here. Unusual times, but making the best of it.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Angel, we think back to all that Darryl was a part of. I'll share just a couple of things off the top of my head and all that he represented. But as we said, number two draft pick of the Cowboys back in 89, and then, of course, went on to a couple of Pro Bowls. I was really impressed when I think it was 2010. Is that when Emmitt went into the Hall of Fame, 2010? I think it was. We were all up in Canton, Ohio. And I was just a row or two behind Diane, Darryl's lovely wife, and they were up in Canton, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you could see Emmitt got very emotional up on the stage as he was thanking those that had been a part of his journey, and he looked down at Darryl, and I think he had you stand up, as I recall. Had you stand up, and he said, Darryl, you know, hey, the reason I'm up here right now, I wouldn't have been here had it not been for you. Boy, it doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, it was an amazing moment, and people will ask, you know, what are some of your favorite moments? And that one is definitely at the top of the list, and probably, if not tied with, but being there the day that he broke Walter Payton's record in Texas Stadium, you know, that was another great moment. But he summed it up so well. I remember the line. He goes, you looked after me like I was your little brother. And that's kind of how I explain our relationship, because people ask about it all the time, and I do have a little brother, and I don't get to talk to him as much as I'd like to. I don't get to be around him as much as I'd like to. And there's a lot of the same dynamics with my relationship with Emmitt that's very similar to my relationship with my little brother, Derek. So when he said that really hit home to me. But to get that validation in front of all your peers, and especially the group of Hall of Famers who were on that stage, was an amazing tribute by Emmitt.
Yeah, it really was. Very, very, very special, but well-deserved, certainly well-deserved. Angel, I tell you what, let's kick it off. We'll go to you to open us up and get us moving with DJ.
Well, you've had an incredible football career. There's no question about that. I'm really curious, being a transformation coach, how you've made the transition and completely reinvented yourself as a broadcaster. What was the hardest part about that? And maybe it was an easy transition, but a lot of people going through change, and maybe their careers as well. Maybe you can share some insights there.
Now, before you answer, though, I'm going to say one thing. We were kidding around before we went on the air here, Angel. You're in New Mexico, so you didn't hear this conversation. But back in 1996, when I was still at NBC5 anchoring there, was asked to anchor or co-host the Daryl Johnston Show, which appeared on NBC. And so I said, oh gosh, I'd love to. Well, Daryl had this television show. So I would kind of set it up, and then he'd answer and, you know, question all his guests and what have you. And we finished the first show, and I turned to Daryl and I said, I don't know what you're planning to do after football, but get your microphone ready because you got a career in broadcasting. He was a rock star that very first time, Angel. So before he answered the question, I want you to know that he had this in his blood a long, long, long time ago. He was a rock star back then in that first show.
Yeah, it was funny. I tell everybody, we get the question all the time, how come there's so many Dallas Cowboys, ex-Dallas Cowboys in broadcasting? And I said, well, it was like a training ground for us. I mean, we had Scott Murray, Brad Sham, Dale Hansen. They all had shows. We were all guests on their shows. So we were continually just doing reps and getting comfortable in front of a camera, which is probably the biggest thing. And one of the things I struggle with still to this day is speaking too fast. You know, there, I see so much information during the game, and I want to get it all out. And I know I only have a little bit of time. So yeah. Instead of kind of, you know, mentally very quickly prioritizing what I want to say, I'll just try to get it all out there. And it's still probably one of my biggest stumbling blocks. But the transition was really a gradual one, because you're still talking about the game you love. You're trying to be an ambassador for the game. You're trying to create new fans, you know, have your passion become tangible during the broadcast so people become interested in the game. So that's the way that I approached it. And it made that transformation a little bit easier because you were still in your comfort zone. And as I mentioned before, you know, we had on-the-job training because of our Super Bowl teams. I mean, everybody had a show in Dallas. Our long snapper had a radio show, for crying out loud. So, you know, everybody had the opportunity to be on radio, to be on television, and to do, you know, pretty much practice reps for years before we stepped in front of the camera as a transition into the next phase of our career. And one of the compliments I got, you know, when I was playing, you know, if we won the game, there was nobody at my locker to talk after the game. If we lost the game, there was like five people waiting to talk to me. And I said, where are you guys at when we win? I said, well, we can get a soundbite from anybody when we win, but when we lose, you're the only one who's honest and tells us, you know, what happened during the course of the game in a way we can understand it. So, you know, that was one of the things that I'll always remember. And I've tried to stay true to that. But for me, in every phase of my life where I've transitioned out from football to broadcasting, then to some of the front office opportunities with the Alliance of American Football and the XFL, you know, I've always relied on my work ethic is kind of the foundational piece. And one of the things I found out with broadcasting is there's a balance you have to strike with how much preparation you do going into the game, because nobody wants to hear what happened from Tuesday to Saturday. They want to understand what's happening right now. And I think early in my career, I was overburdened with too much material from Tuesday to Saturday, and I couldn't react to what was happening in front of me on Sunday. So it was the first time in my life where I kind of had to back off my preparation and find a way on maybe a 30,000 foot view of the game to have concepts and ideas that I could adjust to on Sunday. So it was really kind of learning how to prepare in a different way, which is probably the biggest challenge in going from being a player to being a broadcaster.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I'm curious to know also, because you get into the NFL, you're in college, and you get some of the limelight in college as a player, especially if you're a high performing player. But how does the NFL prepare you, or players in general, for the limelight, for this incredible lifestyle, especially being Super Bowl champions? And really becoming more role models in the community? And does the NFL or Dallas Cowboys, I mean, what was that experience like as far as the leadership training is concerned?
Yeah, the NFL has gotten better at it. When I first came into the league, they had a lot of room to grow in that area. They weren't really focusing on the player away from the game of football. And they've gotten much better at that. It started to happen probably during my career. You know, some internships and some off-season opportunities to work in businesses that you had an interest in. You know, it's great to find out what you want to do. It's also good to find out what you don't want to do. And at that time, you could get into businesses in the off season and find out if there was a passion there for your post football life. I found it hard because to me, I'm all in on one thing. So for me to be able to balance my off season, which it would have been able to be done, I just elected not to do it. But we had a lot of guys that took advantage of the mentorships. And then they also started to work with you, you know, in front of the camera, how to build your brand, you know, how to, you know, be a good ambassador for your team. They would work with, you know, NFL charities and different things like that to get you involved. We did have, you know, with the NFL Players Association, some groups start to formulate, you know, plans for guys while they were playing in the NFL and then post NFL. But I've always felt that, you know, as soon as your NFL career ends, there's not a support group there to help transition you. And that's hard. You're talking about guys in their late 20s, early 30s, who now have to go reinvent themselves. And I wish the NFL would stay engaged with these guys longer during a transitional phase into their next chapter of their life. They still haven't gotten there yet. And I think, you know, a lot of people look at the salaries and they see the numbers that are these guys are making in yearly salary, but that's a small few. There's very, very good salaries for the role playing football player in the NFL, but it's not going to be enough to sustain him through his life from 27 to 65. So I would like to see the NFL be more engaged in that transitional phase and help these guys out. We learned a lot more from our teammates at that time. You know, we weren't getting a lot of help from the NFL. So, you know, Troy Aikman was a guy who has tremendous natural leadership qualities and, you know, just being a great ambassador and knowing that he was the face and the voice of the Dallas Cowboys for his entire career, how well he had to be in public, you know, how he had to be a part of the community. And I think if you were to watch, you saw a lot of guys follow Troy's footsteps to become locked in with a charity, to do different things in the community. So we actually probably learned more from our teammates than we did from the support of the NFL during that time. Now, as I said, the NFL is getting better, but I really think where they could use a lot of improvement is to just come up with a 3-year plan as guys transition out of the NFL. It's very hard to get contact and to get answers from the NFL. I was blessed to be able to move from one career as a player into another career as a broadcaster seamlessly, but I've watched a number of my teammates and my peers struggle for years, and sometimes that struggle becomes life-altering.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can see the emotional well-being being very difficult. When the game ends and that career is over, I could see where a support system is definitely needed. Yeah, that's interesting.
Let's just talk about you and your broadcasting. First of all, let me say congratulations. 20 years this year with Fox, is it not?
Yeah, 20. Troy and I are the longest tenured broadcasters.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, think about that, though, Daryl. As I go back, you know, in all my years, I was in broadcasting over 30 years as an anchor, and I saw a lot of people come and go, and along the way, to do that, I was once told when I was first in the business, the average tenure of an anchor, a news anchor or a sports anchor on television was 18 months.
Wow!
And now a lot of those people were in small markets and went on to big markets, but overall, that's less than 2 years. That's unreal. So for you to be 20 years on the national level doing broadcasting of NFL games, congratulations. Well deserved.
Well, still to be recognizable and relevant to kids that are watching the game now, because it's been a long time since I played. So, you know, they don't remember me.
Who's
playing.
This guy?
Like, who is this?
Moose who?
Three Super Bowls? Who, that guy?
Let's talk about highlights. And Angel, you'll I know the answer to this one already, but I just want him to share it with the audience. Highlights of your career as a broadcaster. And favorites that you have worked with along the way.
Oh, that's been probably the reason why I've been able to stay in the business as long as I have is the people I had an opportunity to work with. I've already mentioned you and Brad Sham and Dale Hansen and everybody that we got to work with here while we were still playing.
Right.
You know, kind of learning the trade and the craft, you know, as a potential second career. Mm-hmm. But then when you got the opportunity to actually move into broadcasting, you know, the first guy I worked with was Bill McAtee. That was my first assignment was with Bill McAtee, and just had a great time. So much so that when I got the phone call and they were going to make a change and move me up, I didn't want to leave. I had so much fun with Bill and my
crew. Billy's a great guy. Do you know he was an anchor?
Exactly.
Back here?
Yeah.
Back here. When Vern Lundquist back in 82, 83, mm-hmm. before Hanson went to Channel 8.
Exactly. I mean, I watched him on the Masters. Yeah, I knew he was in Wimbledon, so I'm getting to work with this guy. But
great friend.
My first go around with CBS was, we were on the seventh crew. We had a partial schedule. So the seventh crew are all guys that have worked on lead crews in smaller positions and mm-hmm. now are going back down in an elevated position to work their way back up to go from a BA or an AD to a producer or a director.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working with a bunch of guys who are young, aggressive, want to create their own style. So it was just a great mix of guys. We had one game together. And it was a game where Ryan Leaf actually was when he initially hurt his wrist. It was Seattle Seahawks. At the San Diego Chargers, I was able to get on my soapbox a little bit, talk about some things. And there was a situation that had happened at CBS at the time, and they were trying to figure out what they wanted to do with the number three spot. So I got moved from the seventh crew to the third crew and went from Bill McAtee to Kevin Harlan. So now I go to work for Kevin Harlan, who's still in the business today. I mean, Kevin Harlan does everything,
basketball, football,
he's everywhere. And I got to learn and work with Kevin Harlan for the remainder of that year. And that was when High Def had come in. So we did the Thanksgiving game, the AFC Championship game, and the Super Bowl as a secondary broadcast for High Def Television. So, my first year in broadcasting, I get to work with Bill McAtee, Kevin Harlan, and I'm doing the AFC Championship game and the Super Bowl. So my wife has always said, you're divinely led. And that's probably
life is
an
good,
example.
Huh?
Yeah. And the funniest thing is I had done NFL Europe for Fox in the spring, and they were the one network that really wasn't interested when it came time to sign somebody. So I was at the Super Bowl Ravens Giants in 2000, and Rudy Martsky, the writer for the US Today,
remember
USA
him well
today had, yep. He had a big Super Bowl party every year, and it was mainly media and network people. So I got an invitation there, and I got to see Ed Gorin, and Ed Gorin was at Fox,
right,
and he was
right.
The guy that was in charge of the broadcasting element, and he and David Hill had kind of started the whole network. And I saw Ed, and I said, Ed, just for me moving forward, I said, what was it about the broadcast that you didn't like? He's like, what are you talking about? I said, well, Fox never gave me, any dialogue back and forth, and you didn't give me an offer. He goes, well, yeah, that was my fault. He goes, you're a running back. He goes, you guys, you're natural. You're instinctive. You're not good on television. That's what running backs are. Unless you're O.J. Simpson and you're charismatic and you're all that. But he goes, as a rule, running backs are just natural runners and they understand the game and they just don't connect with the viewer. And I said, well, Ed, I'm a fullback. I'm not a running back. I said, we have to learn the game. He goes, I got that now. I got that. I watched you. You did a nice job. He goes, CBS has you on a one-year contract with no option. So next year you're going to come to Fox with us, and you're going to be working with Troy Aikman as we prepare to move Troy into. So he lays out the whole plan. So I found that out, at the Super Bowl.
No kidding.
So, yeah. So I go to Fox and I get to work with Dick Stockton, and work with Dick Stockton for 6 years, 8 years. Bob Stenner and Sandy Grossman were my producer and director who worked with Madden through that whole phase.
Right.
Then I move on to Kenny Albert, who might be the most consummate professional in the business. I've never seen anybody as prepared as Kenny is. He could probably do three games in 3 days in three different sports if he had to.
Well, he had a good teacher, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, never make a mistake. Yeah, right.
His father,
and then I'm with Chris Myers recently. So, I've been blessed to be able to work with people who are great in the industry
mm-hmm.
and then kind of learn from all of them. So I've never forgotten how fortunate I've been to be around good people.
All right, and share the story. To me, the all-time greatest, Vern Lundquist, is a dear friend and people like that. So I just have great respect for their abilities as broadcasters. But if I had to pick one, it's probably the guy that I remember as a kid growing up, Pat Summerall.
Yeah.
Just didn't say much, had that incredible voice, and was just so, just was there.
Yeah.
And you got a chance to work with him.
I did it, probably, the greatest opportunity. I mentioned all those guys, but those were my regular partners, but every once in a while I got to work with Pat. I was able to do some Cotton Bowls with Pat. Actually the game that Emmitt Smith broke the record, I swapped crews. Another great thing, Ed Gorin, I'd like to be there when Emmitt breaks the record, if, mm-hmm. if it's possible. He said, just let me know when you think it's going to happen. So I called and they flipped the broadcast and I got to work with Pat Summerall and call the game that Emmitt broke the record in. But when Pat passed away, I had somebody reach out to me and said, hey, we're just doing a Pat Summerall tribute, and we know that you had an opportunity to work with him on several occasions, and we'd love to have you come on and just share some stories. And I said, oh, absolutely, I'd be honored to. And I'm waiting in the queue as they're coming back from commercial, and my introduction is, and now, you know, we've got Daryl Johnson up, and Daryl Johnson was the last broadcaster to do a game with Pat Summerall. So Daryl Johnson, welcome. And he goes, are you there? And I'm like, is that true? Was I the last guy that worked with Pat? I had no idea.
Unbelievable.
I had no idea, but I have the distinguished honor of doing the last broadcast with Pat Summerall. So doesn't get much better than that.
No, it doesn't get much better than that. Good for you. And he lived just down the street, a couple of blocks from me in the Colleyville South Lake area. And so I'd pass his house, and you know where he and Cherry were, and I just, you know, wow, there's Pat Summerall. It just was over.
Greatest compliment I was ever paid is, you know, after that game, and obviously it's the last game that Pat did as a broadcaster, and you get to that age where the game is moving fast, and
right. Maybe
you're not being able to keep up with it. And when the game was over, Pat's wife Cherry was there, and she said, "Pat, that was great. You know, it's like the good old days." And Pat Summerall looked at me and said, "If I worked with him, I could work for 5 more years."
Said that to you?
Yeah.
Boy, is that the ultimate compliment, or
right?
What?
And just being a good teammate. You know, I make mistakes during the course of a broadcast, and Pat had a couple of stumbles, and he's my teammate, so you get him out of it. You know, you have fun with it, you play off of it, but we all make mistakes. You're on the air for 3.5 hours.
Right.
You're not going to be perfect. No. So, you know, I've always told everybody I work with, when you hear me make a mistake, let's fix it right now. You're not going to embarrass me. You know, it's more embarrassing to read about it the next day. You know, let's get it fixed and move on and keep doing the game.
He was the best.
Yep.
He was the best. And he was just one of the kindest gentlemen you'd ever want to meet. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a quick story, kind of get off that, but he, you know how he got into broadcasting?
Yeah, I do.
Do you?
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Charlie Connerly, that was his roommate in New York, the quarterback for the New York Giants. And of course, Pat was the place kicker. And after that game in 58, you know, that they call the greatest game of, you know, when Alan Ameche and Johnny Unitas in was it overtime, I think. But at any rate, that championship game of 58, but then it was like 61-62. And Frank Gifford had just was doing some radio and something. They said, wow, an ex-ball player doing some broadcasting. Wow, how unique is this? And they liked Charlie Connerly because here he is, the quarterback of the Giants. And say they were kind of the Dallas Cowboys of the day, you know. They were the team, the Packers and the Giants. And so there's a phone call, and Pat picked it up because Charlie was taking a shower. And it was CBS telling him, come on down for his interview. They wanted to hire him, and they said, who is this? He said, well, this is Pat Summerall, and, you know, that great voice that he had. They said, did you ever do broadcasting? No. So you want to come down and talk to us? Well, do you want to talk to Charlie? We'll talk to Charlie, but come on down. End of conversation. Pat got the job. Charlie did not. And most, you know, iconic broadcaster maybe of all time in football.
He called the house one time, and we had the old-fashioned answering machine and left a message, and my wife would never erase that message.
You're kidding.
She just listened to the voice.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
God, that's unbelievable, he's called.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's bring it up to current times. Angel, do you want to kick us off here with all that we're going through with this pandemic and what have you, and start us off? We certainly want to ask talk to you about the NFL and what's going on with the NFL and what have you.
I think I'm really curious because, Scott, you and I have had the opportunity to talk with a lot of people and hear from a lot of people. Even today's most well-known motivational speakers who admit to be struggling during this time. You know, 2020 has been a difficult year for so many people. And Daryl, you are a leader in the community. You're a leader on the field. You're just a very well-admired person in general. And I think that parenting is the greatest form of leadership there is. And I'm wondering, how have you been dealing with the pandemic from a family perspective and with your kids in college? How are you preparing them for today's massively changing world?
Yeah, it's been tough. You know, we've tried to find the positives in it first. You know, our son was at the University of Michigan, and you know, it was going to be a busy summer, and he was actually going to stay up there and take two classes, and his sister was getting ready to go away to Syracuse for her freshman year, and all of a sudden this pandemic happens, and it's been great to see Aiden and Evan have the summer together that they wouldn't have had the pandemic not happened. So that was the one bright spot, to watch that relationship continue to grow. They're thick as thieves. They always have been, and they weren't going to have this summer together. And they did, and they took advantage of it. They spent time together Their rooms are right across the hall from each other, and Diane and I can hear them, you know, from time to time, you know, having conversations. So, you know, that was a positive. But, you know, the biggest thing was just trying to get Evan in the right frame of mind. As a senior in 2020 at Hockaday, she missed out on her senior prom, her senior lacrosse season, her senior day, almost missed out on graduation. So there was a lot of big moments in her high school career that were taken away from her. So, you know, the one big thing was making sure she was in the right frame of mind. She was okay. She understood. So we had conversations. Yeah, but that time you didn't know what was happening. So you were living day to day. And I think we all felt at some point we were going to get back to normal, and we never did. So for our family, what we're going to do this time around is we kind of know what the schedules are going to be in the fall. Both of our kids' schools are going to close down for Thanksgiving, and they're not going to bring them back in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. They're going to do remote there. They're not coming back until second semester starts. So we're going to have about an 8 to 10 week, maybe even 12 week period where they'll be back home between Thanksgiving and the start of the second semester. And we're going to have a plan in place, you know, for our family to get better at that time. And they don't know this yet. But, you know, we will each submit some things that we'd like to learn how to do. And we're going to use that time as a family to do that. Dancing will be one of the ones high on the list for me. You know, we will go out and take dancing lessons as a family if we can, right? If COVID doesn't prevent that. But there's a number of things that, and I think it'll be fun to see, you know, what the individual people in the family submit is something that they'd like to learn how to do or something they'd like to get better at during that time. But we're not going to waste that time the way we did this past go around. I don't think we took advantage as well as we could have of time together as a family, because we were always anticipating that this was going to end at some point, and it never did.
Yeah, boy, can I relate. Boy, can I relate.
Don't we wish we had fathers all across America, just like the gentleman that just spoke to you, Angel? Huh? Was that a great answer or what?
Yeah, that's some great advice for
parents. And let me throw something in here. As the master of ceremonies for the Father of the Year program here in North Texas every year, I'm going to throw Daryl under the bus, because I'm also on the selection committee, having been named Father of the Year back in 2002. And it's the ultimate award of all the wonderful things that I've been, you know, thrown my way. That's number one. And I've got two of the most incredible kids, just as Daryl has two of the most incredible kids. And I've tried for 5, 6, 7 years to have Daryl be, you see the grin on his face, Father of the Year. And every year he said, I haven't proven myself totally, Scott. My kids are still here. Wait till they're out of the house and moved on. Guess what, Daryl? They're out of the house. Guess who's come knocking next June? Oh, really?
My vote, Daryl, just based on that answer.
Thank
alone.
You, Angel.
Says yep. a lot about you and Diane, kind of parents you are. It's yep. awesome.
Yep. Go for it, Angel. It's kind of tough when you're in New Mexico and we're here, but please answer, ask another question. You're up.
Oh gosh. I have so many questions, and I just want to pick your brain about really the advice that you have for others going through this right now, and taking a leadership role, really becoming a champion through this time. A lot of people are experiencing some the emotional roller coaster of just sustaining a level of inner peace. It's really hard to do right now with everything happening.
Yeah.
If you were to give advice to anybody, what would it be?
Yeah, you've got the uncertainty of what's coming in the future. There's financial stress. You know, across the board, there's very few people in this country that don't have to worry about the financial stress. It's impacting everybody. There's so many things out there that can get you down if you allow it to. So, you know, I've started to kind of get back in touch with my faith journey over the last 3 or 4 years, and it probably couldn't have come at a better time. So for me, my faith has been the biggest thing through this whole thing. I get daily messages, you know, one via email in the Denison Forum, from Jim Dennison, who's a pastor here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I have another friend who shoots out a text every morning with just uplifting, positive messages, because everything we hear on television, on radio, and on the street is negative. And if we don't have a balance there, there's absolutely no way you can prevent from becoming part of the negative vibe that's out there. So I would advise everybody, you know, to circle back on their faith right now, and put your trust in God and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. You know, that you'll find a way through this. It's not going to be easy, but you'll find a way through this. And that's been the biggest reset for me, and the thing that's kept me, you know, in a frame of mind where I can get through this. I can help my family get through this. And then I've been blessed to be working with a company whose mission actually has been helped by this pandemic. You know, we may have something that could be a key asset in getting us back to the old normal, which is what I want to do. I don't want the new normal. I don't buy into we can't have handshakes anymore. We're going to have to wear masks every day from now on. That's not what I'm here for. I'm back to hugs and handshakes and back to being able to see somebody smile because I can see their face. You know, that's what I want. So I will continue to stay positive and work as hard as I can to get back to that. And if you don't have your faith, I don't see how you can make that journey, because today's world has become too negative, and too divided, for anybody to be in the right frame of mind to get through this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I believe that because everything has been wiped off the slate in so many lives that people, it's like we have no choice than to look up right now and make that connection. And I know that's working for a lot of people. So thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful.
A great segue into all that's going on in our world, in the world of sports, and mm-hmm. and specifically the NFL. And we see the concerns, the racism, what happened in Minneapolis, what happened in Atlanta, what continues to happen in Portland, Oregon, and Seattle. And we say these are our cities in America, the greatest land on the face of this earth. Mm-hmm. And what's going on? I just wonder what your thoughts are on all that's taken place. And of course, the NFL, which you were a part of from 89 to 99 and have been, football's been a part of your life for probably 90% of it too.
Yeah. It's been hard to watch our country divide the way it has, along multiple lines, political lines, racial lines, to watch our First Amendment be under attack the way it is, the rights and the free will of the people to be challenged as much as they have been. If somebody dropped in from the 50s right now and took a look at our country, they wouldn't believe it's America. And that's a shame. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the saying, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So we have to embrace what this country was, even the bad parts, you know, warts and all. You know, there's not a country in this world that can look back on their history and be completely proud. And we're just one of those countries. But we are also the only country that fought a civil war to end slavery. We divided our country in half and fought a war to end slavery. I'm not sure if this is correct, but I heard this, that of all the countries in the world, also we had the shortest experience with slavery. Now we were a younger country, but we recognized the evil and the sin of slavery and tried to remedy that as quickly as possible. So the one thing that worries me is we take away all these things that we learned in our generation about the evil of slavery and how bad it was for our country by destroying anything that relates back to it. You know, there's not a perfect person on this planet. It goes back to your faith. So how could a country be perfect, constructed by fallen and failed mm-hmm. people that built it? So it's so hard to judge today what people were doing, you know, 200 years ago. And, you know, I asked my daughter and her friends, I said, go out 150 years from now and tell me what you think those people will look back on you today and say, how could they have done that? Mm-hmm. You know, what will be something that exists today that 150 years from now will be thought about in such a way that they'll be disgusted that it was actually a part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what this topic is about. It was something that was unfortunately not only a part of our country, but a part of the world. And it's been remedied, and we're trying to get better. We've made so many positive steps. And I tell people all the time, you know, let's not lose sight of all the good we've done as we try to become better. Because we have done some great things, but we don't want to talk about those accomplishments. We have a two-term black president in our country, so it's hard for people to start off with a conversation about systemic racism when you have that accomplishment. We have multiple people of color and minorities in positions of power and success. I mean, it's called the American dream for a reason. People come to this country to become something they never would have become in the country of their origin.
Yeah, any place on the planet.
Yeah, anywhere. That's why they come to this country. If we were so bad, why would people continually come to this country for the opportunities that the United States of America presents to those people?
Great point.
So I just think that, again, to your concept here, none of this happens without conversation. And we've got one side, and it's so funny. You know, we had this anti-bullying campaign that went on for years for the schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that's going on right now. We got a bunch of bullies out there.
Absolutely.
And if you say something that they don't like or don't agree with, they're coming after you. They're just a bunch of bullies. And how does our country frown upon that in school, but allow it to happen nationwide? So we've got to get back and have dialogue and have conversation. And until that happens, we're not going to remedy this. And the people in our country are becoming afraid to express their positions on certain topics and have that dialogue, because they're afraid of what the repercussions are going to be. And that is not where this country can be. We've got too many freedoms in place here that are being infringed upon. And the number one right now is freedom of speech. And it's not coming from our government. It's coming from our communities. The people in our country, our fellow Americans, are silencing perspectives and points of view from people because they don't agree with them. And that is not the foundation that this country was built on.
So you see, your family in 1989 became the National Football League, mm-hmm. Dallas Cowboys specifically, but part of the NFL. You were there till 99. And the last, as I mentioned earlier in the program, the last 20 years, you've been in broadcasting with Fox. I mean, that's an incredible journey, an incredible legacy that you have created for yourself and done it in such a positive, uprising, focused, very just integrity-driven way. You really have. And so, I mean, that's 30, 35 years. So as you look back now over all that has taken place and now what's taking place, be it the NFL, whatever, what goes through your mind? You talk about our community and our world, but it's become a part of everything. It's engulfed just almost everything.
Yeah, we don't have an escape anymore. We go to a concert and the performers start to talk politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go to an athletic event and there's politics interwoven through the entire fabric of that experience. So we don't have any escapes anymore. And I'm disappointed to see the way that politics has invaded everything. So for the NFL, I actually thought they had done a really nice job the last few years. And I've had an opportunity to sit down and talk with a number of these guys, you know, Malcolm Jenkins and Lorenzo Alexander and Doug Baldwin, you know, some of the guys that really pushed this conversation mm-hmm. forward a couple of years ago, and the NFL responded and gave them platforms and financial support. And they did some great stuff. I mean, Doug Baldwin did some phenomenal stuff in the state of Washington with some of the things that he pushed through, and his dad's a police officer. So he's seen it from both sides,
mm-hmm.
You know, to watch Malcolm Jenkins, you know, with a big voice and a big platform, you know, I'd like to see him be a little bit more inclusive in the conversation and allow, you know, other people that maybe have a different opinion than him to be heard. You know, Lorenzo Alexander is one of my favorite guys in the NFL. He's a quiet guy. He plays for the Buffalo Bills right now. And I've reached out to Roger Goodell on several occasions and told him Lorenzo Alexander is one of the guys you have to have mm-hmm. on your committees, you know, to help push this issue forward, because he doesn't just talk it. He walks it as well. And he's done tremendous stuff in the Buffalo community. And that's where I'm from. That's where I grew up. I grew up in Western New York. And to see somebody who not only talks about it, but goes out and gets into the community and actually does it. So there are some great guys out there doing some great stuff, and we don't talk about it. We talk about where they fall short. You know, we're critical of other people. We never celebrate the good or the small victories anymore. And that's been one of the disappointing things. And the NFL didn't talk about any of the good stuff they put in place over the last 3 or 4 years when this whole protest came up. They went right back to being on the defensive and not saying, hey, listen, we get it. We can be better. We all can be better, mm-hmm. but we've done some good stuff here. Let's celebrate some of that as we start to learn and move on. But everybody just wants everything right now. Everybody wants results immediately. And it takes time. That's a tough sled to push. That's the thing that I would like to see everybody start to understand is we're making progress. We're doing better. We're not there yet, but we're at least we're moving in the right direction. And we've got good people behind us that we're working with that are really into this. This means a lot to them. They're not just, you know, spokespersons or figureheads that just get out there and talk and stir the pot. They actually get out there and get on the streets and do some great stuff. So we need to start celebrating some of the small victories and some of the accomplishments that we have. And unfortunately, our mainstream media really likes to point out the mistakes and mm-hmm. actually sometimes create mistakes that aren't even really there.
I was going to say so they stir the pot a little more than they need to stir.
They're stirring it so much it's never going to stop spinning.
We've got a national election coming up in November. What would you do if you were president right now? If what are some of the things that you say, this is what we, and you kind of just shared some of them, but overall.
Let's take all of the science and the data, everything we've learned from back in February when this thing first came to our country and start really getting some good answers. Mm-hmm. And for me, the whole thing about this is all going to be resolved when the vaccine comes out. You read the reports, half this country is not going to take that vaccine. Mm-hmm. They're not going to take a fast-track vaccine. And that's just people who might not be anti-vaxxers. That's just people who are concerned because we're starting to see that this is not as deadly a strain as it was. We understand the people with comorbidity. We understand how it impacted the elderly.
Right.
You know, we are learning through this whole process, and we can be smarter moving forward. And that would be my first thing would be the safety of the people of this country, mm-hmm. but understanding that I can't put everybody in a bubble. So, and I think we're transitioning into that phase. I think the current administration right now, their number one priority is protecting the most vulnerable in our society right now. And that is something that I hear said repeatedly, and that would be your best way. But you've got to allow the other people who are less likely to get this, or if they do get it, they're asymptomatic, that they need to be able to live their lives. We're not thinking about the ramifications of not going back to school, of not allowing people to get back to work because they have to stay at home with their children because they're not in school. The domino effects that are happening around our country with all these decisions and the negative impacts that they have. There was one early on in the pandemic, they did number of deaths in a certain state in our country was this, overdoses from opiates was this, and suicides was this. And the suicide and the overdoses were far and away greater than the deaths from COVID-19. Those are some of the things that we've got to start to look at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other evils and other dangers out there along with this pandemic that are under the layers that we don't know about right now, and we're not talking about them right now. So that would be the biggest thing for me has to be safety and how do we get there? And then going back to what I said earlier, I'm going to do everything I can to get back to the old normal. I will not accept a new normal in this country. I will hug you and I will shake your hand when this is all over. So if you don't like that and that's something you don't want, I will respect that with you and I won't do that to you. But just so you know, when you see me when this is all over, I'm going to want to shake your hand and give you a hug. And if that's something that you're not going to be comfortable with moving on, then I have to respect that decision. And so that's our biggest thing is we've got to get back to respecting what other people think, because we're always going to have a different idea or set of ideas on what we think is correct and how we should do things. And we've lost respect for the other people's opinion. And we've got to start getting that back.
Boy, isn't that the case. Angel.
Wow. I'm with you, Daryl. But as we things up here and go down the final stretch of this incredible interview, I'm really just wanting to know, you've had an incredible career, and how do you want to be remembered? I mean, what's the legacy that you want to leave behind?
I was the best husband I could have been. I was the best father I could have been. And I left a positive impact on the communities that I lived in, whether that's back home in Youngstown, my time at Syracuse University, my time here in Dallas. That I left a positive impact where I was. I think we all want to be respected. I would like people when they think of what I did, to think of it with respect. you know, hard work has always been a foundational component to who I am. And that would probably be one. Whatever he was doing, he always worked as hard as he possibly could to do things the right way. And it comes back to that, that saying, you know, the true behavior of a person comes out when nobody's watching. You know, I would hope that when nobody was watching, I behaved in the correct way.
Yeah. That's integrity. That's character.
Yeah. Yep. Sounds like a John Wooden quote.
Yeah. Right.
This was quite an honor. I wish I was there in person so I can meet you face to face.
We'll do that again. We'll make that connection in the future. And we'll shake hands and hug.
I'm a hugger, so I'm
there.
Good,
we go.
That.
Good.
I had told Angel what a rock star you are. And as I said at the top, there's a lot of great athletes and individuals that I've met over my lifetime and really have been most blessed to be able to do so. Men, women, blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asian, whatever. But I tell you what, you have always been one of my favorites. You just, because of what you just shared, you're committed, and all the, I guess the verticals on what a great champion is: courage, commitment, character, compassion, and someone that knows how to have a civil conversation and move forward in a positive, productive way with integrity every single day. That's Daryl Johnston. You have become the poster boy of that. And so I look upon you as a dear friend, as a longtime friend, and somebody that I wish you and your family, Diane and the kiddos, continued success. And thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. Those are very, very, very kind words. Yep. To Angel's point, that's what you hope for, right? When your people talk about you.
Well, you've done a good job. So our thanks to Daryl Johnston, number 48, the Moose, three-time Super Bowl champion, broadcaster with Fox now 20 years. So until next time, I'm Scott Murray.
And I'm Angel Carlton. And thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out leadershipamerica.net. Until then, be your best self.
You got it. And as we always remind you, live your life as a go-getter, but share your life as a go-giver. Till next time, so long, everybody.